Welcome to the Florida Tiger Bay Clubs Election Series 2020. This series is brought to you by a partnership of the Tiger Bay Clubs across the state of Florida. Partnering clubs include Central Florida, First Coast, Flagler, Gold Coast, Manatee, St. John, South County and Venice, Suncoast, Tampa, and Volusia County. And now, our host and moderator, Yvonne Fry, from the Tampa Tiger Bay Club.
Hello, and welcome to today's event, the last of a collaborative series among Tiger Bay clubs across Florida presenting topics of statewide interest during the 2020 election cycle. Today, the fourth event in this series, we offer a wrap-up of Florida's impact on the national election scene and explore trends we saw play out across our state during this season. Tiger Bay clubs around the state share a common goal to educate and engage citizens on the pressing issues and political races affecting their communities. In this joint effort, we recognize the need to do the same at the statewide level. Thank you to each of the clubs for their work to bring these programs to audiences across Florida. I also want to recognize and thank our production partner, Tampa Bay Arts and Education Network, for their support. This event is being live streamed on Facebook, TV, radio, and websites across the state as organized by our participating Tiger Bay clubs. As we present the final event in the Florida Tiger Bay Club Election Series 2020, we remain a country deeply divided. We have a lot to consider and to discuss today. The presidential election hasn't been officially settled. Former Vice President Biden is preparing to move forward as the winner, while President Trump continues to contest the outcome of the race. Florida's vote went for Trump overall, and while Biden and Harris claim the national presidential victory, Democrats lost ground in not only our state, but across the country. And once again, pollsters tried to predict the outcome in races and capture trends we would see from this cycle, but many times they were incorrect. Many are asking how our country sets out to heal, not only from the political divide, but also from the surging pandemic. I'm excited to welcome four very distinguished panelists who are all deeply involved in this election cycle to give us a solid 360-degree perspective on what just happened and what happens next. It's my pleasure to welcome and introduce our speakers today. First is Mark Caputo, a Florida-based reporter for Politico. We also have Dr. Susan McManus, a voting expert and USF Distinguished Professor Emerita, and Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative, as well as Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster. Hello and welcome to each of you. I want to outline our event structure and ask for each of your consideration of our time limits. We're going to begin with an opening question, which you'll have 2 minutes to answer. You'll have 1 minute per answer on the subsequent questions. We want to get to as many questions from Tiger Bay members from around the state as possible, and also want to give each of you equal time for your responses. I have a clock on my screen. I'll let you know if you've gone over your time. As I mentioned, in the Tiger Bay tradition, our questions come from members of our clubs. In this case, the 10 Tiger Bay clubs from around the state that are presenting these forums submitted questions from their members. And our question coordinators, Tampa Tiger Bay Club board members, John Godwin, a Democrat, and Lee Lowry, a Republican, have prepared them for today. I'm going to open with the first question with a time limit of 2 minutes. If each of you would share with our viewers the most important thing from your perspective that came out of the 2020 election process. Mark Caputo, would you start with that answer?
The most important thing in Florida is that the Democratic Party is in shambles, assuming it was ever really up and walking around and capable of taking nourishment. They say in football, and pardon the sports analogy, the most important play is the next play. I look to the next election in 2022, and I think, my God, Donald Trump in 2020 won Florida by a greater margin than Barack Obama did in 2008. What does that say about Marco Rubio's reelection and Ron DeSantis' reelection? I think it bodes really well for them. There's going to be a national reckoning, and it's happening already, about whether to compete in Florida or not at all, whether Florida is a swing state or not. I don't think it's a swing state anymore. We've now been kind of bucked down to battleground. The debate that you're hearing in the Democratic Party is understandable. Where do we go from here? But I just wonder if their problems are multi-layered and almost too tough to fix, starting with what they don't like to talk about, which is their voters. Their voters are unreliable. It's very difficult to win an election with an unreliable voter base, especially compared to the Republicans. And then secondly, the most important thing is candidates, and their candidates on the whole has just not been as good as the Republican candidates. And then comes things like party structure and financing and the like. Don't get me wrong, you need money to compete in an election, But when you combine all these factors together, you look at the amount of money that was poured into Florida and the final result, it really makes me wonder how much of a red state we're going to become and how much more of one we will be. You're already seeing signs from Ron DeSantis of taking an increasingly conservative approach to things, including expanding the Stand Your Ground self-defense law to cover property crimes and property-related offenses. I think that's a taste of what's yet to come. I'm not sure if I went over my 2 minutes or not. I'd like if I had a shot clock, but that's kind of my first off-the-cuff thoughts on what I saw here in 2020.
Thank you, Mark, and welcome. We're glad you're with us today. Dr. McManus, what was the most important takeaway for you this election cycle?
It's underscoring an old message, which is that a great ground game wins elections. And you can see from the get-go that the disadvantage that Democrats had once COVID hit was the instructions not to go door-to-door campaigning and registering voters. And they had to suddenly defer to social media, virtual town halls, all of those things, while Florida Republicans didn't miss a beat. They kept going door-to-door, social distancing with masks, and asking people to register, and they, of course, closed the gap in the registration between the two parties, but also canvassing them to find out what big issues were on their minds. So I think that's an old lesson that was really vividly played out here, is too much reliance on social media is still not going to be a really solid personal contact ground game.
Thank you, Dr. McManus, and welcome to you. We appreciate you making the time to be with us today. Steve Shale, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Go ahead, sorry. I mean, listen, the most important thing in this election cycle is Joe Biden's going to be president. I mean, that's the biggest thing that happened this cycle. I mean, we're going to have a new president by the landslide margin that Kellyanne Conway described their last win. Joe Biden's going to win 306 electoral votes. He's going to win, you know, probably 80 million popular votes, and he's going to have the second largest win of a non-incumbent president since FDR. I mean, that's a big deal. And, you know, I think there's a lot of self-loathing going on in my party right now. Anybody who thought the beating Donald Trump was going to be easy was completely not paying attention to reality. And, you know, there are a lot of things that were exposed in the select selection on my side, some of them self-inflicted, some of them structural, as Mark said, and we can get into that. But it's a hell of a lot easier to fix that stuff when you have the president of the United States. And, you know, Joe Biden's win is a, you know, to quote him and Obamacare, it's a big effing deal. And, so I think in the end, like, you know, yeah, I mean, we can happily talk about Florida and talk about structural stuff in my party. But in the end, the biggest thing this election cycle is Donald Trump will not be president and Joe Biden will be.
Thank you. Welcome. You're pretty clear on that. Ryan, welcome to you, Ryan Tyson. What was the biggest takeaway for you in this cycle?
I'll say two things from my perspective. Number one, for my party, the Republican Party this cycle finally got better at using data to direct field, which results in turnout. Dr. McManus referred to that. I like to tell a lot of folks from my vantage point, we basically tried to copy the 2012 playbook from Obama. Register voters, build on the enthusiasm that we could see in our data that existed within the various demographic subgroups that we would exploit that enthusiasm with, and then turn them out to vote. So I think that's a big deal for my party, that if you think about the beginning of the century, early 2000s, getting into the mid-2000s when we were getting beat by Obama two times, we know that media is important, but we've gotten a lot better at field, a lot better at ground, and I think that's a big deal for my party moving forward. The second thing I would say is this. Yes, Steve is right. Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States. Yes, it's going to be 306 electoral votes or whatever that comes out to at the end. But I think it's also important to remember that just like in 2016 and just like in 2012, the margin in several of these states is very, very close. If you take Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia, you're talking 45,000 votes differentiate the two candidates at the top of the ticket. If there's better field in those states, if there's a couple of atmospheric conditions that go differently, you now have a 269-269 tie. So I would just say that, yes, Joe Biden's going to be president of the United States. I think his only mandate is not be Donald Trump. And I think that's evident by what happened down ballot all across the country, specifically in the Congress. Washington Post saying that we're probably only going to have a four-seat majority difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. State legislatures, Republicans picked up three of them heading into a redistricting cycle. Eric Holder didn't win a single race, a single state that his group played in leading up to this cycle. So I say yes, they won the big prize. But I also say we are a very divided country. If you get just a little deeper than this top level, you can see how close this thing really is. And there's no way to predict how the next 2 to 4 years are going to look, in my opinion.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you to each of you. Welcome. We're excited to continue this conversation with questions from our members. And our first question is from Deborah Belanti, a Democrat with the Tampa Tiger Bay Club. And Ryan, I'm going to start with you on this question. She says, is it now time to finally agree that polls aren't accurate? I think you may take issue with that. Would you start with that question?
No, I'm actually going to answer it this way. I'm going to let Mark Caputo answer that question for me. Go ahead, Mark.
Ryan's been good about this, and he points out it's how you read a poll that really makes a difference. Yes, the polls do miss certain demographic groups. Good pollsters, and I'd put Ryan in that group. I'd put him in the group of the best pollsters because he was one of the people throughout the 2020 election cycle who, because of 2018, I trusted. And I kind of ignored a lot of these big public polls. Now, even Ryan's own poll toward the end showed a little more of an advantage for Biden than wound up obviously taking place in Florida. And what a good pollster does is know how to read the poll and how to know when what the data is saying and what it's not saying. Now, you can take a top line, and this is partly a media problem, and I'm in the news media, and spin a story of like, oh, it's a 49-48% race. A good pollster will tell you what it means. And I think pollsters do need to do a better job, not calling out anyone here specifically, in their sampling methods and techniques and continue to improve upon them. The news media needs to do a better job, and I would include myself in this category, of how to report those results. And I think out of the soul searching that we in our industry loves to beat itself up and then resist criticism at the same time, that's one of the things that I as a reporter I'm going to try to do better at doing. I did better in 2020, but at the same time, I was still subject to looking at all these public polls and being tugged partly that way and then tugged the other way by good pollsters like Ryan.
And I would also add to that, too, never trust the survey you didn't pay for. That's a motto we have in our office. Steve's agreeing with us on that. And I would just add to your questionnaire, we saw what was happening in Miami-Dade from the very beginning. Our final Miami-Dade survey showed the president only down 9 points. He lost Miami-Dade by 7. We had the president up consistently 2 points throughout the final closing weeks of the election. Our final sample got a little too far left of center. We didn't want to weight it, and it showed that Biden had strengthened. But when we analyzed the internals, we thought that the president was going to win Florida by 2 points or more. So, no, I disagree. I think public polling is done. I don't think there's a problem with private polling whatsoever.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what did you see on the polling front this cycle?
I look at it differently from what impact it means in terms of voter behavior and candidates. First of all, a really interesting study was published this year by some political science scholars that looked at long-term what happens when one party is leading by so much for so long. Does it hurt in terms of turnout? Does it hurt that candidate's supporters because of complacency? Or does it hurt the candidate who's behind because people just give up? And the answer, very definitively and conclusive, was that it hurts the candidate that's in the lead. And I think that you could see some of that in the Florida turnout issues among Democrats. But secondly, and this is just as important, it can also hurt candidates. And there were a number of candidates who lost in Florida that complained bitterly that their internal polls were showing them up by 10 or 12 points. And that affected how they campaigned and the urgency of what they did to alter their strategies. So these bad polls can have an impact on both voters' behavior and also on candidates.
Thank you. Steve Schell, would you round this out, the discussion on polls?
Yeah, I mean, listen, like Ryan, I've been a pretty loud critic of public polling in Florida. I once got in a fight with the Quinnipiac University that was so obnoxious that the Columbia School of Journalism actually wrote an article about it. So, I mean, I you know, and I mean, fundamentally, this is a problem, and I'm not blaming Mark, but the media views public polling like crack. They can't help themselves. If they see names and numbers next to them, they're going to print it. And all these organizations understand that, and they realize it doesn't really matter how good a poll they put out or not. Somebody's going to report it. Somebody's going to get to go on TV and talk about it. And so, you know, and most public polling is done, as Ryan knows, it may be 1/10, 1/20th of the cost of what folks like he and I will pay for a poll. It's the equivalent of, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, any product you're buying, it's a really cheap product. It's not often scientifically based in anything. And it's mostly just trying to make news. And so, you know, I don't think polling is dead in any way whatsoever. I mean, I found out, you know, recently the Biden campaign had them down one going into the election here. I mean, that's not, that's kind of right in the margin. But these public polls are just, unfortunately, they become more about organizations getting coverage than they are actually being informative.
I'm sorry to, if you don't mind me adding, one of the things that we did at Politico, and I certainly did, which I didn't do in the past, is didn't put numbers in headlines anymore, and we backed away quite a bit from doing that horse race poll-based coverage because, you know, I'd been kicked by that mule a few times and just wasn't going to do it again.
Yeah, let me say one more thing, too, that's a problem in our state, is people from outside of Florida do not really recognize the language diversity in this state, the impact that our age structure has on polling, and using broad categories that really hide some very important subgroups. A perfect example would be the Latino vote, which was very different by country of origin, and yet a pollster from outside of Florida is inattentive to that kind of information. They should do their homework a little bit better before they poll a big diverse state like ours.
Yes, agreed. Agreed. We're going to move on to our next question. Thank you for the discussion on that. The next question is from Mark Proctor, a Republican from the Tampa Tiger Bay Club. He asks, is Florida still considered a swing state? Some national commentary has suggested that Florida is now a red state. We touched on this earlier. Steve Shale, would you care to elaborate how you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, I think Ryan said something a minute ago, which was right, which is like, it's just hard to know what the next 2 to 4 years are going to look like anyway, in any way you look at it. I mean, you know, you can make the argument, and I certainly did back in, I mean, people made this argument after George Bush won Florida by 5 points, that Florida was not a swing state. Nate Silver wrote a whole article about it. 4 years later, Obama won Florida by 3 points. In the intermediate 4 years, Democrats won 3 of 6 statewide elections, picked up 10 seats in the legislature and 5 seats in Congress. And yeah, I just think, you know, again, there are some structural things, as Caputo said, that benefit Republicans. They have more certain voters than we do. They have more likely voters than we do. My party's not registering voters this year had an impact on the outcome. But, you know, and I mean, as I've said before, like I wouldn't argue, I mean, I would not dispute it's a lean red state. But again, I think that we got to be, I think if we've learned anything in the last 10 years, it's not to take any too big a lesson from any one election cycle.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what do you think? Are we still a swing state?
I'm going to give you 2 answers. Republicans say absolutely not. We've won. We've gained seats in the congressional delegation and legislative on the governorship forever. The Democrats say, yes, we are. And they have a right to say that a lot of their problems in this election, frankly, was just the way the campaign was run. And so that's remediable. So I think the bottom line is that most people still look at Florida as a swing state, and you look at our registration, and in terms of the expectation in this election that we would be a swing state, nothing proved it more than the fact that we received the most money spent on TV ads of any state, and we also had the most candidate visits in the 11th hour of the campaign when it mattered most. So yes, if you're a Democrat, you still think we're a swing state. You can fix it by fixing your campaign. No, you're a red state if you're a Republican and look at all the accomplishments at the state and congressional level.
Thank you. Ryan, what do you say about this one?
We are a swing state. Any Republican that remotely thinks that we are not, I would love to spend 20 minutes with you and I can convince you why. I think candidates still matter. All it takes, in my opinion, is for the Democrats to nominate a historical figure like an Obama, and immediately he can put back the demographics necessary to be successful in this state. I believe that we've seen a change in the kind of people who've moved in here as the economy got better, somewhere around 13 and 14. We could see the kind of whites that were moving here and where they were moving and how they've behaved politically and how they're now helping to swing elections. But who knows what the next 2 to 4 years are going to look like. And I'm adamant about this because candidates still matter. I believe what Donald Trump was able to do with Hispanics in Florida, and we know it wasn't isolated to Miami-Dade. We all know that now. There was improvements in Broward and definitely improvements in Osceola County as well. But that was candidate-driven on both sides. And I think anyone who believes that when we move into this next midterm that candidates still don't – that they think that candidates don't matter, I would say that's wrong. And I think everybody would be shocked that the Democrats could be very much competitive depending on a couple different factors going either way. I'm a Republican, have been for my entire life. I just feel like the demographics of this state don't lend us to be able to be out of the woods and say you're either a lean R or whatever. There are intangibles that would lead you to say that. But I still think that things could change really fast on a moment's notice. And I don't expect that depending on, you know, historical kind of candidates. And by the way, Trump was that in Florida, as Obama was as well. I feel it's dangerous for my party to think that we're now a lean R state, in my opinion.
The only one here. Yeah, no, we're not a swing state. We're a battleground. Yeah, and I understand I'm drawing a distinction here. My thing is this. You're a swing state if you swing. Like, we're not swinging anymore. Now, a battleground can get updated to a swing state as soon as you start swinging again. But until that happens, it's just, I mean, the record is what the record is. Well, 2014, Republican wave. 2016, Republican wave. 2018, Republican wave. 2020, Republican wave. I mean, at what point are we going to start just admitting, you know, we are what we are? I agree with Ryan that great candidates make a big difference. But this, like, all it takes is Obama. I mean, that guy was like a fantastic candidate, almost like invented in a lab. And Trump was actually, to a degree as well, a media lab. So, yes, great candidates make a huge difference. But in a state as big as Florida with 10 media markets, where, you know, it can cost $3 million a week to get your message out statewide on television, and Democrats already worried about plowing more of their precious resources into what's become a graveyard for them, it's difficult seeing the state swing again. It's possible. Let's see the candidates. But until then, battleground.
Thank you. Strong feelings there all the way around. Our next question is a continuation to a degree of that question. This is from Tom Scherberger, a Democrat. He asked, how do you explain the seeming contradiction between the minimum wage passing but Republican candidates succeeding statewide? Dr. McManus, help us understand that.
Well, obviously, if you look at the patterns, if you at the vote, you could see that the rural part, the panhandle, was the part of the state that voted no on that. But the rest of the area of the state was pretty supportive. And I noticed right off in the coastal areas and the more affluent parts of the state that you saw a heavier vote for that. And that could come from two different ways. I haven't really looked at it as carefully as I can't look at it. No one else can either, really. But for a lot of the wealthier people that have moved into Florida, and just some native Floridians as well, looked at that as an example of where something needs to be done and to draw people to work in those areas and so forth. And also, if you live in one of those kind of areas and you're really suffering as a middle or low income person, you're going to be supportive of it as well. So I think that a lot of the means and the concerns and the ability to pay, even among wealthy, are a bit more supportive because they recognize, again, not only is it helpful, but it also relates to the kind of workforce that can be attracted to the area.
Thank you. Ryan, how do you make sense of the juxtaposition of those two anomalies here?
Absolutely. Some context for that is take us back to 2004. Republican George W. Bush is running for re-election. He wins the state by 5 points, 380,000 votes, and the minimum wage law that we live under today got 71%. It's not uncommon for a Republican to win the state and minimum wage go. Why is that? Well, when I've done research on the subject, there's too many voters who just out the gate approach the subject of minimum wage and say, yes, it should be higher. They can't tell you what the minimum wage was, but they just felt that it should be higher. And I think what this amendment faced, and the reason why it got as close as it did, it probably could have gotten a lot higher, it's that, I don't know if everybody recalls this, did you see those bold letters at the very bottom of the amendment? That was from a legislation in Tallahassee back in 2019. That would require an economic impact statement be placed at the bottom of that ballot. If you all recall, it was a very strongly worded statement, and it's different from the fiscal impact statement that you're used to seeing on the ballots. This thing basically foretold that there could be tax increases locally, revenue reductions based to meet these new employment or these wage standards. I think that was the biggest reason why this amendment almost failed. There was not a lot of money to defeat this amendment. Obviously, the people who were going to be disproportionately hurt by the minimum wage going up, they had been disproportionately hurt by the pandemic. And then also, you're seeing a lot of different retailers, big box stores specifically, that have been moving that way by going more to automation, self-checkout, things of that nature. So first, just a basic answer, not surprising that a Republican wins Florida and it still goes, still supports the minimum wage amendment because we've seen it before. But I do think that it was a lot closer than people thought because, in my opinion, of that economic impact statement that was at the very bottom of that amendment.
Thank you. Mark, what's your take on this?
The Republican Party is heavily a party of, even in Florida, where there's a lot of retirees, working class voters. Working class voters work, and a lot of them work in minimum wage jobs. And for some of them, they're able to kind of have their cake and eat it too. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, who I like, who represents some of my cultural values. And hey, I'm going to get a minimum wage increase. So it's not that surprising. I mean, you saw the same thing with medical marijuana, right? There are Republicans out there, even though the Republican, let's say apparatus, for loss of a better term, was against the medical marijuana amendments. A lot of people realized it was just good policy. You know, voters, behave in interesting ways, but sometimes in very predictable ways. And when there's something concretely in there for them, they're going to approve it. Like, you'll see the same thing with local referenda on tax increases in conservative areas, and they pass. Well, why do they pass? Because the voters there look at the amendment there or the referendum, and they're like, oh, hey, this actually benefits me. I know where my money's going. I'm going to vote for it, even though I'm generally anti-tax. Same thing here. I'm a working class person. I'm tired of being paid $8.75 an hour. I should be paid $15 an hour, especially now that my CVS job, even before this, was being surplus due to what Ryan pointed out was automation. So it's not that mind-bending for me. The most surprising thing for me was how dumb Joe Biden was in his campaign in not wedding himself to something that was very popular. Like, you know, if you've got something that's going to get at least 60% approval, you should advertise it, especially with Biden, who is in favor of raising the minimum wage. You didn't hear anything from his campaign out there about it.
Yeah. Steve Shale, last word here on this one.
Speak up, Steve. Mute.
Sorry. I'm at that age where I need somebody to come help me.
Steve, you're muted. There we go.
Yeah. So I think I think we all assume that somehow voter behavior must be tied up and down the ballot. Right. And I think, honestly, we've now seen like 8 cycles in a row where the evidence is that voters are separating all these conversations. I mean, Democrats thought minimum wage, as Ryan said, in 2004 would help them win Florida. Republicans thought putting an amendment to ban gay marriage in 2008 would help them win Florida. Didn't work. Democrats thought that the marijuana stuff would help them. Most outside observers thought that the Democrats, that the felons restoration of rights stuff in 2016 being on the ballot would help Democrats. I'm of the position until an amendment actually shows that it impacts the top of the ticket, we just need to stop assuming that and recognize, as Ryan and Mark and Susan have all said, that voters are able to differentiate these questions in ways that I think we often think they don't.
Thank you. We're going to leave it at that, but we're not leaving Amendment 2. This next question is from Nancy Granda, a Democrat. She asks, in what way do you think the Florida legislature might impede the implementation of Amendment 2, the amendment to raise the minimum wage. Steve, would you start with that one?
You know, honestly, I haven't put a whole lot of thought into that at this point. I mean, I'm certain that there will be efforts in the implementation to be very specific in the types of jobs and whether or not they can limit businesses. I mean, I don't, I mean, honestly, probably, you know, Ryan is probably closer to that than I am. I'm certain that the legislature will try to put guardrails around it, but honestly, I just, you know, I'm still a week out from a presidential and I haven't hardly got my brain around mowing my yard, let alone that question.
Man.
Yeah. Ryan, can you help us with this one? What do you think?
I have absolutely no clue what may be in the minds of the legislature. I'm not a lobbyist, so I wouldn't know. Sure, there may be something, but it seems pretty cut and dry. I don't know how you get around the schedule that was in that amendment. But then again, maybe they'll try.
Yeah. Dr. McManus, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Sort of like Steve, I've been inundated of late, but one thing that you do know that needs to be explained to people that wasn't adequately done, this increase doesn't occur immediately. It's phased in, and I think that a lot of voters didn't recognize that they're not going to instantly get this raise that they had anticipated.
Yes. And Mark?
Yeah, I'm with everybody else. I think if the legislature can water down the will of the people, it will. Now, how will it? I don't know.
I don't know that I heard everybody else say that, but we'll leave you with that as your last word. So we'll move on to the next question from Dennis Lopez, a Democrat. He says, Amendment 3, the amendment to change Florida's primary to a top two primary system failed to pass, getting 57% of the vote, shy of the 60% required. With over 3 million no party affiliation voters in Florida, and that number increasing every year, what is your opinion as to why this was opposed by both parties when millions of voters are currently being left out of the primary process? Dr. McManus, would you start with that one?
Yes. First of all, when people really found out what it meant, that changed some minds. In political science books, for example, we always talk about open primaries as being structured so that you maintain both parties, but independents can choose whichever party's primary they choose to vote in. That's a more popular approach, but when people suddenly found out that they could end up with a governor's race with two candidates from the same party, suddenly the idea didn't seem so great. And the argument from a sort of a more theoretical perspective is that the two parties do offer people choice in terms of policy differentials and so forth, and that there was a potential that that choice, which is an essence of democracy, would have been eliminated. So again, more information people gained on this one, the less enamored they were of it.
Thank you. Mark?
Yeah, I'll admit it, I voted against it. I didn't like it. I don't like the fact that the parties are able to stick the taxpayer with the bill for closed primaries. And I think if something that would have made the parties pay their fair share for having closed primaries, had that been on the ballot and had it been pitched to taxpayers, I'm pretty sure that that would have done better. But, I mean, the reality is, like, if you looked at the ballot amendment to begin with, it was just, like, all of this long language. And a lot of people, if they don't know, they're going to vote no. And when you have a 60% threshold that requires approval, every no vote has more power than every yes vote. Because the basic structure of these things is that if you're trying to pass something, your opponent is spotted 10 points, right? You need to pass something 60-40. So you had on top of that the Republican Party of Florida. I'm not sure about the Democratic Party. They had made pretty clear that they didn't want this. And all it just takes is a little bit of partisan pressure and resistance to a constitutional amendment that's going to crumble. And I think we saw it crumble as a result.
Thank you. Steve Shale.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, honestly, I mean, part of it is neither party they want to be able to control their own stuff. I mean, that's part of it. I'm for opening up the primary system personally. I think it would lead to less extremism in both parties. I think if they'd gone to the ballot with something similar to, like, say, South Carolina or New Hampshire or Illinois, where a voter can walk in and choose which primary they want to vote in, I think that would have passed without a problem. I think, you know, for all the reasons everybody else laid out, I think it just became complicated and it was easy. And the Republican Democrats did spend money. I got a piece of mail about it. I'm not sure why they were spending money on it versus things that actually would impact winning the election. But, you know, yeah, I just think you both party interests lined up against it. It was confusing. And, but I do think if it was a different structure, I think it probably would pass.
Thank you. Ryan, last word on this one.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that I've heard so far. A couple other things that I would point out is, number one, maybe a logical reason why the parties didn't vote for this is that we're not in the same position as Georgia is about to be. Many voters may have thought that that meant runoffs, like, later than the election. I'm not quite sure about that. Obviously, Georgia's about to have an election on January 5th. They're about to be inundated like a war is occurring in their state. So some voters may have thought it was that, although that is not the policy that was before us with this amendment. I will say that one of the party's points that I thought was very logical was on the Democrat side. They were making comments as to how this may impact minority representation in the legislature, specifically African-American representation. And I wholeheartedly agree that it would likely retrogress on the number of African-Americans that would be in the state legislature. I have that opinion just based on precinct level analysis that I do in Democrat primaries. But having said that, I could see why the Democrats had the position that they did on this amendment. I won't comment on why the Republicans may have felt the way that they did about this, but I do think that all of the speakers make a very good point. This probably wasn't the best way to go about getting other independents the ability to get involved in the partisan primary process. And there's also, let's just be very clear here, the base of both parties think if you want to be in their party, you should join their party, not get to influence it from the outside. It's just a hunch.
Yeah, thank you. We're going to move on to our next question from Dan Malloy, a Republican. He asks, is our traditional application of First Amendment free speech protection now a threat to our democracy, given the viral dissemination of false but protected political speech on social media platforms during elections? If we could start with Mark on this one.
I guess I'm a little purist on this one. My first reaction is no. Maybe I have too simplistic and yet too complicated a view on the problem with disinformation, but ultimately the problem is one of belief. This country has a crisis of faith and a crisis of belief. And that kind of manifests in the fact that so many of our fellow citizens want to read that Joe Biden is part of a cannibal pedophile cult. I don't know how that can be cured by censorship writ large. Now, we are seeing the First Amendment work in that people have the right to espouse the crazy stuff that they espouse as long as it's not dangerous. But the social media companies are also exercising the same care to a degree, or they're exercising care to not allow that to foster and fester as much on their platforms. But I think our problem is not with our rights or even with those who seek to abuse those rights, but that we have such a large population that wants to believe this stuff. And maybe it's a problem with our education system to begin with, where people don't understand how to read news anymore or how to see it. But I think it's deeper than the First Amendment. That having been said, I'm in the business that the First Amendment kind of enshrines. And yeah, it's troubling when we have a population that's as large as it is that wants to believe fake news over real news.
Thank you. Steve Shale, what are your thoughts on the fake news?
I don't know. I mean, I probably find myself pretty aligned with Mark on this. You know, obviously it's the stuff that, like, the QAnon stuff, which is way too mainstream and is, I think, honestly, a real threat in a lot of ways. Trust me, my Twitter mentions sometimes are all I need to know. And I'm sure Mark's are too, that there's some people with some really crazy and unhinged views of the world that are, you know, own guns and, you know, make you want to hide your address where you live. That being said, I mean, in the other part of my life, I do a fair amount of mentoring of young political leaders in the developing world. And in a lot of those places, like, speech is attuned to potential death. I mean, you know, I mean, I've, like, in the Philippines, there's about 100 elected officials who are extrajudicially killed every year for things they say. And so, you know, I think that, you know, it's a really slippery slope to start going in and trying to dictate what is speech and what isn't speech. I do think, again, both political parties, and I'm going to say my own as well, I mean, like, need to do a better job of calling out BS, and they need to stand up to it, and they need to be able to back down. I have no problem with privately owned social media companies pulling stuff off that is, you know, and labeling things. That's fine. But I just don't know where you, like, what's the line? Who's the arbiter? And I think that's where it starts getting dangerous.
Thank you. Ryan.
I've long believed that that social media, which I'm not great at, other than showing what I'm barbecuing that weekend, I've long felt, though, that these platforms have been a vehicle that the most extreme elements of our society are able to be louder than they would have ever been, and it's also helped factions of them organize in a way that they never would have been possible had these platforms not come into existence. Having said that, it's free speech. It's their right to be there so long as they're just publishing this content. I think it's very sad that with freedom and with the ability to have the First Amendment comes great responsibility. It's sad that a lot of our fellow Americans, both parties, they're not responsible as they should. They're not responsible adults. My own mother has sent me things that she's had on her Facebook, and I'm like, Mom, don't you realize that a Russian agent probably created that? It's very sad, though, that that's what we're seeing in our society today. And I would also add, it's very sad that these tech companies are making billions off of essentially a platform that's divided this country. It's unfortunate, but I don't think it can change. I really hope that we get a lot more responsible. I think it's sad whenever you look on Twitter and they feel that they have to nanny state everything. It's and on the one hand, people should be responsible, but on the other hand, they have to nanny state everything with warning labels. I can't wait till that gets off of my social media feed. So I'm a little bitter about it, honestly. I don't like what's happened in our country, and I think that social media, I've said this to Mark many times, I feel like social media is a big driver of that, because again, it's the fringes that social media gives such a disproportionately loud voice than they would ever have.
Yes, thank you. Dr. McManus, last word on this.
Well, as a person who went to college in the 60s, I am a strong advocate of freedom of speech, and I see a lot of evidence of it being repressed in many different venues, and it very much troubles me. But education is one of the keys to helping with this misinformation. We know for a fact a lot of people don't know the basics about government or who's responsible or all of that. But also what you've seen is an inattention to the fact, and my colleagues here have all mentioned it, people no longer rely upon the traditional news sources that older people do, as our country has generational replacement and the younger generations come along, they get their news sources from vastly different places and their political news from vastly different places than we did, my age. There's also a tendency to look at traditional news sources for a lot of people. They've gone to these other venues because they see bias in the traditional news sources. And if you don't, you're not in step with that, partisan bias in particular, you're going to look elsewhere for your voice. And a lot of times misinformation is spread and reliance upon it are because people do not feel their voices are being paid to attention to whatsoever.
Thank you. That's a big one to unpack, and I don't think we've seen the end of the concerns on this by any means. So our next question is from Greg Davis, Republican from Flagler Tiger Bay Club. He asked, what are the lessons to be learned for each party from this year's election? Steve, would you start on this one for us?
Sure. Hey, Greg, good to talk to you, man. Real quick, you know, you never know who you meet going door to door when you're helping a candidate. In Flagler County, when I was a 21-year-old pup in my first campaign, I knocked on the door of an African-American woman named Shirley Chisholm. And when she opened the door, sure enough, it was Shirley Chisholm, who had retired from New York to Palm Coast. And so pretty kind of cool story. I got to know her a little bit later in her life. But I don't honestly know. I think the problem is parties learn the lessons they want to learn in every cycle. I think I'm hoping from my side that we learn that you have to build long-term sustainable infrastructure in states, that we have to get back to candidate recruiting. You know, Mark made a point earlier on my side. We the last 3 or 4 cycles for state legislative races, particularly in Florida, like, we haven't really recruited. They've taken the first person that raised their hand. Like, we got to get back to the basics of recruiting candidates, organizing on a year-round basis. I still think the median voter theory, which is the idea that most elections are won by candidates closer to the ideological center of that district, is true. I think we need to get back to that as a party. And, you know, but, you know, then again, I mean, it's just these things unfortunately become echo chambers. And again, people learn the lessons they want to learn.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what do you think the lessons for each party are from this cycle?
Well, both of them sort of the same thing, and that is that you really have to look at nuances. And for example, Republicans did do well in their idea of expand the base to include more women candidates, make inroads with Latinos, a lot of inroads even among Puerto Ricans, and also African Americans, particularly men. So expanding your base, not being complacent, assuming, and the counter of that, or the sort of a parallel, is don't assume cohesiveness forever from groups that you've seen as traditional parts of your base. I think that's a lesson for both parties here. And another one that I would point out is the people putting a national template over Florida and trying to win Florida doesn't work. And of course, people here that are talking know that, the party people, Ryan and Steve, know that. But people outside of Florida are still trying to assume that everyone here is a senior voter, or that all young people vote alike, which they did not. The Gen Zers went for Biden. The millennials went for Trump, different reasons. This is a state where we have such a diverse population that nuances matter. And I think that's a big lesson that both parties have taken away from this election.
Thank you. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I think the Democrats did great. I hope they don't change anything. There's no lessons to take away. Just keep doing what you're doing. but for my party, I hope, to, as Dr. McManus highlighted, it candidates still matter. Okay, we must have a more diverse support base. I'm glad she mentioned millennials. Incredible growth that we saw with millennials with our top ticket that nobody would have ever thought possible. Very, very important lessons that we were screaming from the rooftops in 2012 that needed to be learned. I think the party got. I think you could see that reflective in the kind of candidates that were recruited and the kind of candidates that, like, the House and the Senate were supporting throughout the state. So those are lessons that it'll be interesting to see. But once you get the top of the ticket shifted out, it'll be interesting to see if we maintain those lessons leading into 2022 and then again in 2024. But again, I just hope the Democrats just keep doing what they're doing.
I'm glad you have a sense of humor here. Mark, you're up for the last word on this one.
I think the lesson for the Republican Party is actually to kind of keep doing what they did, in that Donald Trump took Miami-Dade seriously after he got destroyed here in 2016. He lost by almost 30 points. This go around, he lost by only 7. And that was partly because he paid so much attention to Miami-Dade, paid so much attention to its voters and to policy. For the Democratic side, I'm not sure that they're ready to hear this, but calling Donald Trump and Republicans a racist is not working. Donald Trump was called a racist for 4 years, an anti-Black and anti-Latino racist. You heard about kids locked in cages, immigration. And Donald Trump turned around and got a higher share of the Black vote, of the Latino vote, and the overall share of Black voters, I believe, relative to whites, fell compared to 2016. Now, I'll need to check that, but just at least on the margins, he improved his standing. Now, there's a variety of reasons for that. And Donald Trump, I said before, is akin to nuclear power. He provides a tremendous amount of energy as well as radioactivity, which kind of throws off our conventional measurement instruments. But on the messaging, it doesn't appear that calling Republicans racists work. And the reason we can start to say that is Joe Biden got creamed here, and Andrew Gillum also lost when he was running against what his supporters called Ron DeRacist. So they're going to probably want to retool that message because it's not appearing to work.
Thank you. We're going to look forward a little bit. This next question is from John Godwin, a Democrat. He asked, what influences will this election have on the Florida 2022 gubernatorial and Senate races? Steve, would you start with that one?
My dog's been barking. Forgive me. I keep it in mute. I don't know that there's like a lesson that comes out of it. I mean, you know, ambitious people are ambitious. And, you know, I think that we're going to have a robust primary for governor. I think we'll probably have a robust primary for the U.S. Senate. I'm not sure anybody's going to look at this and decide not to run for higher office. I suspect on my side, we're going to have, you know, three or four pretty high quality candidates running for governor. I don't think anybody's going to look at this election and go, man, I'm not going to go run in 2022. I think, you know, political ambition is political ambition. And I think that if there's a lesson of Ron DeSantis and Barack Obama and Donald Trump, which is if you're thinking about running for something, you should run because you never know what's going to happen. I expect a big broad field on my side to challenge Ron DeSantis and probably a big broad field to challenge Rubio. And, we'll see where the country is in 2022.
Thank you. Mark, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think it leans Republican, just judging by our previous elections and what we've seen. And what I'm curious to see is what's the crucible of that Democratic primary look like? What do they find that fantastic candidate, basically Andrew Gillum without the baggage? I don't think Andrew Gillum's problem was his progressivism per se, but all the baggage that came with it. He only lost that race by less than half a point. But at the same time, I'm not sure how progressive state Florida is. That's a question that primary is going to answer. And I'm not sure the Democratic Party is going to be able to field the same type. They're not going to be able to run the same kind of campaign that they were able to run in 2018 or to a degree in 2020, because I think a lot of that national money is not going to come here. Now, if that national money comes here, if they wind up with an Obama-esque figure as I said, Gillum without the baggage, well, maybe it's a different story. But until then, it's definitely a lean Republican state.
Thank you. And Ryan, what does your polling tell us?
I don't think you can forecast this state more than about 2 months in the future at best. I don't remotely get into the business of trying to divine how humans are going to behave in this state in 2 years. I don't think there's any way to know that. I think that Mark raises a very valid point. When you run against an incumbent two-time statewide office holder like Senator Rubio underneath Ron DeSantis, he's a conservative populist, if you would. He's got a lot of broad-based support for a lot of what he does. And I think you have to wonder, that's a buzzsaw if they're raising money. You know, it's a lot of money to be competitive here. Mark raises a valid point. Do people from the outside national groups, which is largely the money that we see spent here, it's not companies in Florida per se, but it's the outside monies that come in, do they do that? These are all questions that matter. And obviously, once again, who are the candidates? Who is it? Is it in a candidate that can inspire turnout and an otherwise lower turnout midterm? Is it? Who knows? Who knows where this country is going to be in 2 years? And I, for one, don't like to get into the business of trying to project what things are going to look like in 2 years. There's a long road between now and then.
We'll circle back as we get closer, though, to hear from you on that one. Dr. McManus, any closing thoughts on this question?
I certainly expect from both parties much better demographic analysis than was done in this election. We've clearly seen the diverse components of traditional broad categories of bases. And you're not going to have good micro-targeting of message or forms of communication if you don't do a better look at the demographics of the state. And as several of my colleagues have mentioned, where people live change. I mean, you can look at counties and the registration can change in a very short amount of time and be very different in terms of the outcomes that it's going to produce. The second thing I would mention is I have a question as to whether going forward we will see as disproportionately much, so much money spent on television advertising as in more non-traditional forms of advertising and communication. I think that might be changing. One thing I'm hopeful that we might have gotten rid of, but I doubt it this time out, since every poll in the world, there you go, Ryan, shows people hate robocalls. And this election cycle, they came to hate texting as well. And running the same TV ad over and over and over and over, people want something fresh. Look at on, you can get memes and you can get YouTube that's current and vibe, you know, vivacious. The same old, and how you reach voters has got to go out the window.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to close out with our last question, talking about the youth. As Dr. McManus just mentioned, the things that they are looking for and so on. Teenagers, many of whom could not vote this year, were extremely engaged, very, very concerned from both sides, both perspectives. And I think indicates the potential for youth vote in the next 2 years, 4 years to be something that we have not ever seen before. Would y'all comment on that? And what do you think that that means for our elections and outcomes going forward with that kind of engagement? Mark, would you start with that one?
Yeah, I always look at young voters as the bauxite of the electorate. They're fool's gold. You keep hearing Democrats like, oh, the young people are going to come out and we're going to win. And then they don't because, you know, we're still kind of an elderly state. Yeah, sure. If more of them show up and more of them vote, it makes a difference. But one of the perennial issues we've seen in this state is that the people who vote tend to be older, tend to be more conservative. And as a result, the conservatives tend to win. Now, not to repeat myself too much, if that fabulous candidate comes along who's able to inspire youth turnout on the left, that'll change. But you know, who knows? There could be a Republican candidate who, for some reason, inspires youth turnout and kind of changes the calculus there. But I've repeatedly looked at the idea that young voters are going to really turn out in force, and they just don't. Now, exactly why, I don't know. Maybe we'll have to have an hour-long Zoom call. But until then, I think this state defaults to its control settings, and it's still an elderly state. And those are the ones who still kind of disproportionately decide the election, them and middle-aged people.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what is your thought on the youth vote going forward?
I see it's definitely getting stronger, and it was up from before the last presidential year. But it's very important to understand you have to look at young people by generations, because generations have common experiences. And just to make a point I was making a little bit earlier, millennials voted for Trump because their life experience, what was one of the biggest things, if you look at life experiences, is that generation matured, turned 18 till it was closed off. The Great Recession was a big issue for them. Their parents lived through it. They saw the struggles. They were also the generation that was most likely to be working in restaurants and bars and service industries. So in Florida, those industries shut down momentarily. And then when they got back going again, they became economic voters. Now, how would you pick up on that if you just assume anybody, millennials and Gen Zers, are the same? You can't reach them the same. They have different life experiences. So let's take the Gen Zers. They are very, very social activism voters. Think of the experiences, Black Lives Matter, the George Floyd, all of the other kinds of Parkland. That's a different kind of voter, that those experiences will affect them and how they vote the rest of their lives. They voted for Biden. So we do see that it looks like this youngest generation is going to be more activism driven on social issues. And as they get more powerful, because we're just at the beginning of that generation maturing, that is going to affect politics. And look no further than Congress, where young people there, the young progressives, have greatly affected Democratic politics, particularly in the House of Representatives. So again, I think you can't just look at this point in time and say, well, give up on young voters, because these younger generations, they're not going to be quiet. They're going to be noisy.
Yes. Thank you. Steve Shale, what's your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I fundamentally believe all great change comes from youth activism. You see it in America in history. You see it around the world. I get a chance to work with some really amazing leaders in the corners of the globe that are doing things that are remarkable, that are going to change our planet in ways we can't even imagine. And I think that's phenomenal. I agree with Mark. I mean, yeah, I think young folks often don't see the connection between their activism and voting. That's frankly, some of that's on the political parties to do a better job. We also, young voters aren't monolithic. Young white voters tend to be Republican, just like white people in general. Young voters of color tend to be more Democratic. That's kind of just like life is in general. But I think the biggest thing about this generation, though, which is pretty interesting, this is the most diverse generation in our country's history, and certainly in our state's history. Something like 70% of voters under 29 are voters of color or mixed race. And I think to me, that's the more interesting thing down the road. This generation is going to change what Florida looks like potentially, and how we think through issues and how, you know, just how the population looks here going down the road. And so, I agree that I think at times get overstated as a voting block, but I don't think their impact on politics and society can be understated.
Thank you. Ryan, last word on this with our young voters.
I want to say that I felt good at a certain point in the cycle here in Florida, at least, when I saw the Biden campaign surrogates were boasting about how well they were doing with old white people. I thought that was a good thing because I knew what, as Dr. McManus has referred to, how well we were doing with under 50 as compared to how we have been in the past. Why that was should be exciting for my party. Number one, I think you did see some sort of a cultural uprising with a lot of the millennials that follow religiously figures like Joe Rogan or Dave Portnoy. The day that the president of the United States granted a sit-down interview to Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports, I knew that they were headed in the right direction. They could clearly see, or I hope they saw, what we were seeing in our data here, which was the president was naturally overperforming with a lot of these people. It has long been assumed that that age bracket was monolithic. They just weren't this cycle. And I think that's good news for my party. But I would also mention again, this is candidate-driven. Mark mentioned this at the start. It's whether or not there's a candidate that these younger voters can connect to. Let's not forget the main point that what did make white voters over 65 more competitive for Joe Biden, these COVID policy shifts, those very COVID policy or inaction, as the Biden campaign would say, on the president's behalf, is perhaps one of the greatest reason why these younger voters were more up for grabs. They didn't want to be out of work anymore. The parents of kids wanted their kids back in school. They didn't want them to continue to shelter in place. So I would just say the story is never final. It was great to see the age groups behave a lot differently than they've normally been behaving in past elections. And I would just wrap it up with this by saying it was refreshing to see an uprising in millennial voters to sort of cancel the cancel culture. People got tired of that. And it was refreshing on my side, in my opinion, to see sort of a reaction to that from younger voters.
We're going to let that be the last word. Thank you again to each of you, our guests, who have spent this time with us to help make sense of many aspects of the 2020 election cycle. Each of you have worked very hard throughout this unusual season, and I hope you'll be able to take a little downtime to catch your breath, and Steve to mow your yard, all the essential things that we've got to do. To our viewers, thank you for joining us and for your interest in the political process across our state. Your informed participation is what makes our state and our country great. I'm also grateful for the collaborative partnership of the Tiger Bay Clubs around Florida, who made these four events happen during our 2020 election series. On behalf of each of these clubs, thank you to our viewers for tuning in. We look forward to continuing our programming in each of our communities to ensure an informed and engaged electorate and to hold more events statewide in the future. Thank you again, and we wish you the best for the rest of 2020 and into the new year. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Florida Tiger Bay Club's Election Series 2020. This series is brought to you by our partnership of the Tiger Bay Clubs across the state of Florida. Manatee. St. John's, South County and Venice, Suncoast, Tampa, and Volusia County. We hope our Florida Tiger Bay Club's Election Series 2020 helps you be a more informed and engaged voter this election cycle.